You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And while I was loving the Seahawks' performance last night in the Super Bowl, the game was something of a letdown. But that didn't dampen the sense of celebration over sports here in the New York and New Jersey area. This hour, how sports has become less of a celebration and more of a tense negotiation over compensation for student athletes. We'll talk about that. Also, a tense worry over security at the Sochi Olympic Games just 4 days away. Thousands of athletes and their families packed up their bags and skates and skis and boarded planes for Russia. There's an excitement for those competing, but everyone gets asked at their departure if they're worried about the relentless stories of security threats and terrorist groups targeting the games.
We're all in this together, and, you know, again, all you can really do is just sort of trust, but, you know, we're all aware, and we're all really excited.
That's women's ice hockey player Lindsay Fry speaking at KJZZ in Phoenix, and Katie Stone, U.S. Olympics hockey team coach, talking to KUOW in Seattle.
You know, we're keeping our eye on the ball, honestly, and we feel very confident that the Russian and the U.S. government will take good care of us.
There is much to fear if you care to look closely. Those twin suicide bombings in late December that killed 34 people in the city of Volgograd. President Obama gave U.S. athletes a pep talk last week on CNN.
What I would say is that if you want to go to the Olympics, you should go to the Olympics. And, you know, we're not discouraging in any way Americans from participating in what is just always an amazing, wonderful event.
But the sober reality of the fears and the immense Soviet-style measures to maintain security were very evident to United States Congressman Bill Keating of Massachusetts, who recently returned from Sochi and spoke to Boston Public Radio.
In one sense, the security investment is enormous, maybe the biggest of any Olympic event so far. There's upwards of 100,000 security people, including 40,000 police, 30,000 active military people. Drones flying overhead, satellites being used, really a lockdown as described by one columnist in Russia.
Keating says, chillingly, there's a parallel competition to the games themselves, and that's the competition to disrupt them.
There's another group out there that wants to be in the world stage right now during these Olympics, and those are the terrorists that have had a bloody and longstanding relationship with Russia.
Representative Keating advises anyone planning on attending the games to register with the U.S. State Department for their up-to-the-minute notifications on security. Is the media worried? Lawmakers just raining on the Olympic parade? Joining us now on the ground in Moscow is Andrei Soldatov, investigative journalist and security expert. Andrei, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Explain what the sense is of security at Sochi. There's certainly a growing feeling that, if not a specific threat, then a sense of malaise surrounds the games at this point.
Well, the problem is that it seems that the Russian secret services put so much effort in securing the area of Olympics, but at the same time they try to combine the Soviet approach to security and the most advanced surveillance technologies. And as a result, we get something quite strange. A combination of very intrusive surveillance measures combined with Soviet approach like blacklist of people inclined to extremism meant to prevent people to buy tickets, and now it's impossible to buy a ticket if you are not checked before by the FSB. And at the same time, we got measures which cannot be used to prevent a terrorist attack but might be useful only to disrupt manifestation or maybe some protest.
Do you think that people have a legitimate concern for being a little bit scared with all of these preparations and all of the statements out of Moscow? Yes, there's an attempt to reassure people, but are people wrong to feel a little bit nervous?
I think there's a case for to be concerned, because it seems that for Russian security services, it's a big deal to put as many troops on the ground as possible, and it's not necessarily might help you to prevent a terrorist attack, especially if we're talking about suicide bombing.
What about the charge that the focus on security in Sochi leaves places like Moscow and St. Petersburg vulnerable to an attack that would be very embarrassing and distracting to the Putin government?
That's a Very hard question. And what we get now, that after Volgograd bombings in December, it seems that militants understood that timing is much more crucial than location. And that's important for them to try to strike during the Olympics than to try to strike the Sochi area. That's why it's actually put all of us in quite a dangerous situation. We understood that any town in central Russia might be under threat of being targeted by militants, because the most important point for them is to make a point during the Olympics.
Are you personally nervous about what's going on? Do you have any sense of festive feelings about the Olympics? I mean, these are supposed to be fun. Are you feeling any of that, or are you very much worried about the next several weeks?
Well, to be frank, I think I'm completely lost with feeling that it might be a manifestation of sports. I'm thinking of the Olympics as of something that might be quite dangerous. We are talking now mostly about the Olympics as something in terms of security problems, or maybe we are talking about Olympics in Moscow as a manifestation of political ambitions of Vladimir Putin. And for many, it's not a festival of sports. We're all quite concerned, especially because everybody understands that in the North Caucasus, we are dealing, in Russian secret services, we are facing not only with one organization, which might be dangerous, but we're facing with a losing network of cells, with many groups, many leaders who are quite young and desperate to make their names during the Olympics. And the Olympics presents so great and tempting opportunity for them to try to do something. And everybody understood that to deal with such a threat, which might be multiple, and that all these groups might be not necessarily based only in Dagestan, but it might be in some other republics of the North Caucasus.
Andrei Soldatov is a Russian investigative journalist and security expert based in Moscow. Thanks so much, Andrei.
Thank you.
We lost not one person over the weekend. We lost many.
I know what exacerbate means.
Okay, well, who's thinking?
There's not a word or a sentence or a concept that you can illuminate for me. There is one singular reason I keep coming here.
Truman.
November 14th, 1959. 3 years ago. And that's all I want to hear from you.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's pitch-perfect Truman Capote in the film he won an Academy Award for. And then this completely different fellow.
I've been with the company for 24 years. I was posted in Greece for 15. Papandreou wins that election if I don't help the junta take him prisoner. I've advised and armed the Hellenic army. I've neutralized champions of communism. I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish, which should come in handy here in Virginia. And I'm never, ever sick at sea. So I want to know why I'm not going to be your Helsinki station chief.
Your course.
Excuse me.
For Helsinki, I need someone with diplomatic skills. You don't have them.
Is that right?
That is right. And I don't know why the hell I didn't fire you when you broke my f***ing window.
Oh, yes, sure you do, Cravely.
The crazy CIA agent in Charlie Wilson's War, or the prissy assistant to the rich Lebowski in The Big Lebowski.
Yes. This picture was taken when Mrs. Reagan was first lady of the nation.
Yes, yes. Not of California.
In fact, he met privately with the president, though unfortunately there wasn't enough time for a photo opportunity.
Oh, Nancy's pretty good.
Oh, wonderful woman. We were very happy to...
These are,
Oh, those are Mr. Lebowski's children,
different
so
mothers,
to speak.
Huh?
No, they're not...
Racially, he's pretty cool.
They're not literally his children.
Think he's got room for one more?
Oh. You never went to college. Please, don't touch that.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was a character actor who filled out blockbusters like The Hunger Games and the Mission Impossible franchise. He was also the cynical journalist mentor Lester Bangs in Almost Famous.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm on cool.
Me too.
You're doing great, dude. The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're on cool.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was cool. He died over the weekend of a suspected overdose. The sadness over that will cast a pall over the upcoming Oscar ceremonies, a place where he was nominated 3 times, a winner once. Hoffman was admired partly because he had such a deep love for acting. He loved to speak about the art and craft of what he did. In the movie Boogie Nights, he showed why directors Mike Nichols, Paul Thomas Anderson, and the Coen brothers and others just loved him. He could go anywhere and often did in his performances.
This is it.
It's cool.
Yeah. Going inside?
When did you get this?
Yesterday. Well, actually, I had it painted yesterday, so it might, the paint might still be kind of sticky. Or...
This is great, man.
Yeah.
This is really great.
You want to go for a ride? Or... I'm sorry,
what the hell was the matter with
I'm
you?
I'm sorry.
Why did you do that, Scotty?
You look at me sometimes.
What?
I want to know if you like me.
Well, of course. Yeah, I like you, Scotty.
Can I kiss you?
Scotty,
please, can I kiss you on the mouth?
No!
Please let me.
Scotty! Do you want to go back inside?
Do you like my car?
Hoffman could do anything in his performances. But in his life, he struggled with substance abuse throughout his career. You could see on the screen often the ravages his body took from the way he lived. You wondered, sometimes, if he was on the edge. But that edge is what always kept us coming back. He was also a mentor, and when he spoke on this program, he talked about how he loved and naturally was a teacher.
Very soon into my acting career, when I had jobs, I started thinking about things in the overall story idea. I remember taking acting classes, and even in acting classes back then, I remember, you know, identifying with the acting teacher in a way that wasn't about an acting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like wanting to get up and talk about acting to the students, you know
right.
what I mean? Like I always had this kind of quality, this teacher kind of thing in me, I guess.
Philip Seymour Hoffman speaking on this program in 2010. But it was the edge that he brought to the screen that always kept us coming back. His fearlessness, his genius, and utter vulnerability. In the Charlie Kaufman film, Synecdoche, he plays an artist, Caden Cotard, suffering from his own bad judgments, fading, lonely, and sad.
I'm lonely.
Yes. Anything else?
I'm hurt.
Yes. And?
I think Adele's right when she says I'm not doing anything real.
What would be real?
I'm afraid I'm going to die. I don't know what's wrong with me, and I want to do something important while I'm still here.
That would be the time to do it, yes.
Albert Brooks tweeted, R.I.P. Philip Seymour Hoffman, one of the greats of his generation. Aaron Paul, we lost one of the greats today. Philip Seymour Hoffman, R.I.P., my friend. You will be missed always and forever. And some heartfelt comments from you as well. Darren Maloney wrote, he was a great Lester Bangs and Almost Famous, so talented, so intelligent. He had the resources and knowledge about recovery, but sadly made a very destructive choice. Daniel Kiever in Michigan, Catching Fire was his favorite. He wrote simply, just amazing. Kristen Nyquist in Seattle says, my favorite was his train wreck of a character in Owning Mahoney. Such a sad loss. He stole every scene he was in. But he will be remembered as a generous actor. Philip Seymour Hoffman gone. A legacy of movie characters lives on. He surely wishes he could be there to be with them all. He will surely be missed at the after party. This is the city the new mayor of Boston saw when he was growing up as a little boy in the 60s and 70s.
Rather than send me on a bus, they sent me to Catholic school. So I remember walking to school and seeing the school buses pull up surrounded by police cars. Now, the school that I'm talking about was peaceful because it was grammar school, but it was difficult to watch our city get torn apart because of forced busing. And I think a lot of people lost out. But in particular, the young people at that time that went to school, they lost their opportunity for an education. And I still think we're feeling ramifications of that.
Mayor Martin Walsh learned a lot about the limits of government intervention watching forced school busing to make the schools of Boston integrated in his hometown. As he grew up, he became a labor activist and remains the president of his local union even today. His campaign, successful campaign to become mayor of Boston, was a merger of populist politics and his own personal story of recovery. He says today that he faces a city united by the tragic Boston bombing attacks, but still divided by pockets of economic despair.
I think Boston in some cases, we're a very unified city. Around Marathon Monday, we united around the victims and what happened on that day. But we're also a city of neighborhoods. In some neighborhoods, there's clearly inequality in those neighborhoods, whether it's around education with achievement gaps or it's around opportunities for employment. So as mayor of the city of Boston, in particular, the way I won this race and having support widespread throughout the different neighborhoods in the city of Boston, we have a lot of work to do in some neighborhoods to make sure we create jobs and opportunity while closing that achievement gap.
And, you know, when you think back to this issue of neighborhoods and think about the Boston bombing, a lot of people talked about in the wake of that Boston bombing that the Tsarnaev brothers were just down the street. Nobody really knew what was going on with them. And yet they were on a radicalization track that took place really right down the block. What do you think that says about the vulnerability of people in cities in America? I mean, we obviously don't want to have police on every street corner, but certainly the idea that you come to the United States and become radicalized to the point that you would do something like the Marathon bombing is a frightening commentary.
I think September 11, 2001, our understanding of safety in America changed. Prior to that moment, we really didn't. Well, we had some concerns, I guess, of homegrown terrorists, but we really didn't experience anything on that magnitude. And from that point, you know, in Boston, I know that I certainly never expected Boston to be hit by a terrorist attack by two cowards. However, it did happen. You know, I think that as Americans, we have to be more alert. I think we have to make sure that we pay more attention. And it's not just Boston. I mean, other countries like England and Ireland and around the world have been putting up with this for a long time. So I think it should heighten our awareness to kind of keep an eye on what's going on in our neighborhoods.
What is your reaction to the Tsarnaev trial, which is going to be an extraordinarily important event in your city while you are mayor, and the decision by the Justice Department to pursue the death penalty?
I support Eric Holder's decision on the death penalty. You know, it's his right to the Constitution, and it's one of the tools that the jury will have if they find this person guilty of his crimes on Marathon Monday.
You've talked very openly about your difficulties as a young man, and that you're a recovering alcoholic, and that in many ways your story has really bonded you with the people of Boston. I'm wondering if the sense of mercy and forgiveness that you've experienced in your own life informs, for instance, your opposition to the death penalty, even in the midst of the Boston bombing story that actually directly addresses the death penalty.
I don't think it affects me in my position on the death penalty, but it certainly affects my position on a whole host of other reasons and issues that to deal with as mayor of the city of Boston. It gives me strength being in recovery, gives me a lot of inner strength here and understanding that people make mistakes and people deserve second chances and sometimes third chances. And I think that's important to, as mayor of the city of Boston, to understand and to try, you know, as we move forward here, understand that people do make mistakes. And that's why I wouldn't put in the same category as the death penalty or what happened on Marathon Monday.
But you are opposed to the death penalty as a matter of principle.
Yeah, I've consistently voted against the death penalty for the state law here in Massachusetts since 97.
Is there some inconsistency between the federal government being able to execute someone for a crime in your state and under state law that being prohibited?
No, not at all. I mean, the way the Constitution's written, it allows the opportunity for the state, any state, to do put a law in the books, but they're all superseded by the United States Constitution. Eric Holder, within his rights, had the right to do what he did.
Finally, remind me how long you were a lawmaker in Massachusetts?
16 and a half years I was a lawmaker. Represented the 13th Suffolk District, which is Dorchester, and one precinct in Quincy.
All right. So then you're in a really good position to answer this final question. And this is for all of our listeners around the nation who I think are probably pretty interested in this. Do you get better seats at Fenway as a lawmaker or as the mayor of Boston?
Well, as a lawmaker, we're shut out of those seats.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we have to, I don't know about that. As the mayor of Boston, I'm not sure. The season hasn't started yet. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I just know that the Red Sox did win the World Series, World Championship, so I'm looking forward to seeing them repeat this year.
And, you know, you're being very cautious here. You don't have any particular clout. You got to stand in line with the rest of Bostonians to get into Fenway?
When I was in the legislature, I was the chairman of the Ethics Committee.
Ha!
So, you know, so I'm also very, very up on the ethics laws.
All right. Mayor Walsh, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Marty Walsh is the new mayor of the city of Boston. What do you think about pursuing the death penalty in that case of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev? Porcher writes on Facebook he should be held accountable for the crimes that he's charged with. If the law that we have states the death penalty, then yes. Ralph says, no, it would cost the people more than putting him in the general prison population. What does Carl say? We should also consider that seeking the death penalty is not the same as putting to death. Sometimes a harsh penalty is sought to compel a plea bargain. Perhaps Holder is seeking the death penalty in an effort to get Tsarnaev to plead guilty and receive life in prison. Let's not always assume that those who seek the death penalty actually desire to put someone to death. Good point there, Carl. And you can definitely keep all of that in mind. Weigh in on this by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post to our Facebook page. And this might be a good opportunity for you to be a part of our listener response network. You can sign up for our texts. You'll get a text a day. We ask you a question that's featured on the next day's program. So your answer to that question might just become part of our on-air conversation. Text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Call it an hourglass full of water instead of sand. The sandy drought in California has put a limit on water supplies. The drips are coming to an end, and people have been given notice all over the state to expect their water to be turned off soon. The State Water Project, the main municipal water distribution system, has announced it doesn't have enough water to supplement the local supplies. Dan Macon owns the Flying Mule Farm in Auburn, California. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what does it feel like to have an end date for your water supply on the calendar there?
It's pretty scary to have a deadline, and to be looking at a summer with very little water is pretty frightening.
So you, what, go to the Yellow Pages and look for trucked-in water? You contact swimming pool maintenance people? I mean, what do you do in that situation?
Well, there's a couple of things that we can do. Everybody's kind of first response is to start buying hay and other sources of feed, but that becomes untenable pretty quickly. So most of us at this point are actually starting to sell off livestock and making plans for reducing the number of mouths that we need to graze.
And if you sell to some place that has water, aside from the transportation costs, can you recover your investment and just sort of hold on till the water comes back?
Well, that's certainly the hope. Unfortunately, it's not ever quite that simple. And, those of us that have been in the livestock business for some time have built up a genetic base in our herds or our flocks that really meets the individual characteristics of our land. And that's not something you just go out and buy right away when the rain starts to come again.
Now, is this a matter of just looking up in the sky and hoping for some clouds and rain and decent weather? Or do you think there's a political concern? California is famous for fighting over water rights and the tensions between the rural and agrarian and farm economies and the urban needs in that state.
Yeah, I think if you look at prior droughts, one of the differences was that we had fewer people that we had to split those water supplies up amongst. So certainly there's a political component to this, and I think that's just going to continue to get more challenging. We do a lot of looking up in the sky and hoping for rain, but that does not seem to have helped so far.
So in the 21st century, the state of California has no margin for error in a case of drought, unlike past years, and you're apparently right in that margin for error.
We are. And, those of us that rely on the winter rains feel it first. It's definitely going to impact vegetable and fruit production as we go through the spring and summer. Unlike back east where you get rain during the growing season, we rely on irrigation in the spring and summer months, and that's where the rest of the country is really going to start to feel the impact of this drought.
What are your neighbors saying? What's the talk about even being able to take a shower?
Well, it's starting to hit home for a lot of our urban neighbors now that they're being asked to conserve. I think one thing it's done within the agricultural community is really bring us together. We're talking about strategies and commiserating a lot, but also sharing ideas with how we might be able to hang on in this situation.
When do you think you'll be out of the woods? How long can you hang on? And what's a real break point of no return for you?
We've got some immediate concerns right now with the lack of grass on our rangelands today. The real impact will be coming next fall for the livestock business, and that's why many of us are starting to sell animals so that we can save some grass for next fall. If we go through the entire rainy season as dry as we've been currently and there's no grass available to graze next fall, I think there's going to be some really severe impacts in terms of multi-generational operations that have to totally sell off their animals.
Well, let's hope it's not yours there, Dan. Dan Macon owns the Flying Mule Farm in Auburn, California. Good luck to you, Dan.
Thank you. Have a good day.
A story my dad used to always tell me. He used to always kind of tap me and say, hey, you know, when driving in the car, he used to say, Russ, you know, why not you? You know, why can't you be a world champion or whatever you want to be? And so I kind of told the guys, you know, why not us?
Super Bowl winning Seattle quarterback Russell Wilson standing on the top of the mountain talking about the road from Pee Wee Football League's high school to the Super Bowl. It's a long, hard road. And that road mostly passes through college. The BCS, the collegiate equivalent to the Super Bowl, averaged 27.3 million viewers this year. And colleges, the networks, all made money hand over fist from that game. The athletes did not make so much money. Last week, though, some college players made a sound to rival Bruno Mars' blistering drum solo at halftime last night. Northwestern University quarterback Kane Coulter, with some powerful backers, including the United Steelworkers Union, teamed up to demand a union for college players. Joe Nocera is a columnist for our partner, the New York Times, and a regular contributor to WNYC's business and economics podcast, Money Talking.
The players in college always basically been on their own. They really don't have anybody looking out for them, protecting them, and even the schools, if they get in any kind of trouble with the NCAA, they get cut adrift. And so basically, this is kind of an old-fashioned exercise in consciousness raising that took place at Northwestern. The quarterback, who's leading the charge here, took a class about unions and came back and said, you know, we need one of those.
That's great. Now, the interesting twist here is that NCAA Division I athletes are supposed to not be paid. So in a sense, they're asking for union representation to deal with the fact that they're not paid, perform a service for the university, and need some form of compensation, or the places where they are compensated, that needs to be recognized in a different way.
Here's what makes it a little tricky. In order to form a union, you have to already be an employee,
right,
and you have to already have an employer. So what the players are arguing in this particular case is that they are getting a salary in the form of a scholarship. They're saying that is a form of pay, and therefore, because their athletics takes precedence over everything else, that is their job.
So on this issue of whether student-athletes are students or employees, the NCAA issued a statement saying that the union-backed attempt to turn student-athletes into employees undermines the purpose of college and education. But the individual who's involved in sort of the counter argument, the College Athletes Players Association, okay, Ramogi Huma, says that if college athletes are primarily students, he says, then they should not devote 40 hours each week to training, traveling, and practicing when their graduation rates are only 50%. Now, that argues that they're not students, that they're actually employees.
It's hard to see how they can be considered students first. Athletics takes precedence over everything. It takes precedence over which classes you can take, when you can take them, quote-unquote voluntary workouts that really aren't all that voluntary. They're working out all year long. And, you know, they're raising literally millions of dollars for their university by going out there and playing. And let me say one other thing. Ramogi is not really arguing right now for salaries. He's arguing for a place at the table so that they can fight for better medical coverage or, you know, an extended scholarship for players whose eligibility has run out and still need to get their degree. They got a whole host of things like that. Now, what happens inevitably, if you put somebody at the table and they're arguing about medical, the next thing they're going to be arguing about is, well, we need some cash. And I think what the NCAA fears more than anything is having somebody who can represent the players. And by the way, we're not talking about millions of dollars anymore in this sport. We're talking about billions of dollars. If you take basketball and football together in the college game, it ranks number two in total revenues behind the NFL. This is not small stuff. Mm. There's so much money floating around that, you know, you have these ridiculous situations like the University of Oregon's locker room facility, which is, you know, looks like it could be in an Aman hotel somewhere. And you have coaches making $5 and $6 million. And the reason is because, as they say in economics, it's rent-seeking behavior. The money has to go somewhere. Why shouldn't at least some of it go to the players?
Joe Nocera is a columnist for our partner, The New York Times. You can also hear Joe Nocera every week on the WNYC Business and Economics podcast, Money Talking. So here's that union argument from the perspective of an actual student, Kane Coulter at Northwestern University.
Student athletes don't have a voice. They don't have a seat at the table. The current model resembles a dictatorship, where the NCAA places these rules and regulations on these students without their input or without the negotiation.
That's the quarterback at Northwestern speaking. Let's get another athlete voice in here. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, former linebacker at the University of Rhode Island, an NCAA scholar athlete, friend of the program. Ibrahim, welcome.
It's good to be back.
So I don't want to know your opinion on this yet, okay? I want to know what you believe, but I want you to take yourself back to Rhode Island when you were an NCAA scholarship player, right?
Correct.
Right. And if somebody came to you and said, we got to have a union here, what would the wheels have been doing in your brain as you tried to figure out whether this was a good idea or, you know, putting an axe in your head?
I think the first thing that would have concerned me was how would this decision affect the coach's perception of the players, and would there be a division between union and non-union players that would affect the chemistry in the locker room?
So really, a student athlete considering this, even though it might sound like a great idea on paper, it has really got some sort of gut check kinds of decisions to make, right?
There's already natural, cultural, economic, class divisions that exist. To add this into the mix, I think it creates a certain point of tension where you could even say that some of the players, this would affect even recruitment. So you could imagine a young person, 17 years old, a coach comes to visit them. They're talking about these things. The coach might float out the question, what do you feel about the unions? Or what do you feel about this idea? And the player may or may not even get a scholarship based on their answer.
I mean, who knows if those considerations are even legitimate, if the NCAA would make rules about that sort of thing. But right now, it is a complete sort of blank canvas, and there's all kinds of reasons to fear, right?
I personally, do you want to know my opinion?
Not yet. What do you think about this idea of dictatorship that Kane Coulter just talked about? Did you feel like it was a dictatorship under your coach? Did you love him? Did you not love him?
The NCAA gives you strict rules around working and around your ability to provide for yourself outside of football, so or whatever sport you play. So if you are a scholarship athlete and you come to the school, you are at their mercy for food, for clothing, for shelter. You literally have no other resource. If you have none at home, then you have no other resource to avail yourself of.
So you can't go work.
Precisely.
You can't go get a job.
You can't get a job. You can't do almost anything other than what they sort of prescribe for you within their framework.
So even if you're like a genius microbiologist and some graduate professor says, well, I'd love you to come work in my lab.
You could do it, but you couldn't get paid.
All right. Final question before we hear your view on this. Did you feel like an employee ever when you were at the University of Rhode Island, an unpaid employee?
The language – I wouldn't say unpaid. The language that coaches and players use when they're going out to practice is going to go to work, got to get to work. That's the language that you use in the sort of vernacular that exists on the field and got to go to work – watching film, got to go to work, reading your playbook, got to go to work on the field for practice. That's the vibe that you're existing within already.
All right. What do you think? Should there be a union for college players?
I think the way that they framed it, the National College Players Association has framed it around the medical expenses of players after they play. Most scholarship athletes in any sport do not go pro. The NCAA has a whole ad campaign related to this.
Right.
To go pro in something other than sports. They're still going to deal with the effects, particularly in football, of concussions and other things. If that is one of the outcomes of this, then 100% I think it's a great idea.
So for you, the medical benefits make sense.
It's a huge deal, yeah.
The pay doesn't make sense?
I think if they find a way, listen, some of these big conferences, SEC, ACC, even the A-10 that I was a part of, they offer grants for scholarship athletes to tap into. They already have pools of money that students are pulling from. Students, if they're smart, they'll fill in the applications and get some of this extra money already. That exists out there. If there's more available for them, I think it's a great idea.
All right, but then what you're saying is that there's already enough money out there to be able to say, hey, they are basically getting paid right now.
They are basically getting paid because, you know, when I was in school, it was like a $20,000 was what the school cost. That, to me, my bill said 000 as a scholarship athlete. That's a big deal. You are playing and you're getting money, but you're getting it directly into the school. So it's not like you're playing for free. It's not like you're just
right.
volunteering.
No,
you're getting something out of it.
Are there some players who aren't scholarship, who basically have no voice, no option, nothing, and they're taking a lot of punishment?
A lot of the walk-ons, you take that risk, you walk on to a major college. Sometimes they end up playing, and they get playing time. Sometimes they'll walk on and with the agreement that if they get some playing time, they'll get some partial scholarships. But a lot of guys walk on the schools, and they don't have any of those protections.
Should they have those protections?
I think if they are playing and they're on the field, according to what this framework of this union that could potentially start, I think it would make sense that if they get out there and they risk themselves, then they should get some protection.
All right. We've talked about pay. We've talked about the medical benefits. Sounds like you very strongly support the medical benefits. Did your college career impede your ability to perform at school to the point where it made you maybe less attractive as a candidate in the professional world?
I once had a not so good grade in a class, and I was going to go to a special study session. I went to my coaches and I said, "Coach, I need to miss practice to go to the study session." They said, "If you miss this practice, you're not going to play in the game."
Wow.
And I had to make a decision that game, and I did not play in that game because I went to that study session. I ended up getting a B+ or whatever in that class because I went to that study session and got the extra help that I needed. All the other players on the team said, "Listen, you're here to play sports, not to go to school." And there was one kid, his name is Christian DeSimone, he actually died on 9/11. He said, go to the study session. And I went to the study session because that's what I wanted to do. And I felt I was there to be a scholar-athlete first.
Final principle, should there be a seat at the table for the student-athletes in this union thing?
If nothing else, then to educate them on their rights as workers and citizens, it should be seen as an educational point as opposed to some contentious fight. But the young athletes should be able to sit there at the table to understand the workings of the system that they're a part of.
And possibly be represented by a union or some other organization. Precisely. Ibrahim, thanks so much.
It was great to be here.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, former linebacker at the University of Rhode Island, NCAA scholar athlete, old friend of The Takeaway, we should add. A lot of you had other plans last night at the Super Bowl. We loved your stories that you shared. Joseph made the point that I watched Downton Abbey and Sherlock. After all, why would I want to watch grown men becoming traumatic brain injury cases live in HD? A very upbeat thought there, Joseph, but I'm glad you had an entertaining evening. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. The following little script is based on events from real life. Soldier. Yes, Master Sergeant. You and your two fellow soldiers will take this government vehicle and report to this address immediately. Yes, Master Sergeant, but this is your home address. Did I ask for any questions, Lieutenant? Now you will report there and move some boxes of equipment and then return that vehicle to base. Is that understood? Your personal stuff, Master Sergeant? Did I say I wanted to get into a discussion, Lieutenant? Do it. Understood? Yes, Master Sergeant. These are just some of the tasty entries in the Department of Defense's Encyclopedia of Ethical Failures, stories of how government employees came up with clever schemes to pull one over on Uncle Sam, and they all ended badly, like the Air Force and Marine generals and a Navy admiral who together billed the government $3,000 for a stay in Tokyo to play golf after their official work ended. $3,000 for some priceless networking on the golf course. Gordon Leubold is a national security reporter for Foreign Policy. He delightfully stumbled on this little document meant to help DOD employees resist temptation. Gordon, welcome.
How are you?
An encyclopedia of ethical failures. I mean, it just, it sounds like something straight out of a, I don't know, a prayer book.
I was certainly laughing to myself when I stumbled upon it. It is, just as you describe, a big catalog of all the best things that they don't want you to try at home. Not every wrong piece of wrongdoing, but clearly a bunch of the ones that the military, in particular, the kind of Office of Ethical Conduct, which is part of the Pentagon's General Counsel's office, is using to kind of highlight what people shouldn't do. And this comes at a time when there's a lot of concern about wrongdoing, especially among senior officers in the military.
And, you know, this is something that really comes out of the organized process and the Inspector General, which actually takes a look at all kinds of things. There is a very organized kind of oversight of all kinds of government programs. What they're trying to do is take some of that stuff that might just get lost in legalese and trying to present it in a form that individual managers can use tangibly to make sure that their employees know that they're being watched.
Yeah, I mean, that was what struck me the most about when I first saw this, was that it's unlike most other documents that is produced by the Pentagon. This seemed to be channeling Al Gore, who you know, famously pushed for proper English use in government documents. This one is breezy and, you know, clearly meant to draw attention about wrongdoing within, you know, its own department.
Although you say it was channeling Al Gore, I mean, Al Gore was not, you know, known as a real chucklehead. I mean, this stuff is kind of funny. I mean, the way the style is beyond just vernacular English. I mean, it's really sort of entertaining to read.
Sure. They have this one is a swing and the one that you mentioned about the golf outing, a swing and a miss for senior officers using government funds on golf outing. I mean, you just don't see this stuff. And honestly, us journos who cover the military try to translate what we cover into this kind of language. And in this case, we didn't have to do that.
No, just quote it as is. Do you know who the author is? Is it some really interesting characters sitting in some office somewhere in the D ring?
Yeah, there's some attorneys who work for the general counsel's office who have put this together and updated it. I think that they've had a little bit of help from public affairs officers who you know are kind of their outreach piece. But I think really it's just these cases when you kind of, when you boil them down to what the wrongdoing is, they kind of just, the stories tell themselves. So it's not hard to kind of put them in a way that is interesting.
I'm surprised that, you know, like William Morris in some story development office hasn't got a hold of this out in Hollywood. I love the one, the DEA agent who was dating the narc on a drug case. I mean,
that was straight out of Breaking Bad, it seemed. The other one, the one that I was my personal favorite, was the Navy commander who faked his own death after meeting a woman with whom he was not married, had an affair with her, and then faked his death by writing some kind of an anonymous email to her saying that he was no longer alive, when he and his family moved away and moved to a house in Connecticut to a new assignment. She ultimately tracked him down.
So this is the amazing part. I mean, I read that story. I had to read it three times before I understood what the heck was going on. He faked his death just to her, not to anyone else. I mean, he was still, as far as the Navy was concerned, alive and well.
Of course. You know, apparently he met her on a dating site. They had several months of an affair, and then he got tired of it. Obviously, this is unbeknownst, as far as I can see, unbeknownst to his family or to anybody else. And so he you know, put together some kind of an email that allegedly from somebody else who I guess would have seemed legitimate and told her that he was no longer alive.
And what was the reprimand for this?
He was demoted, I believe, and probably got what's called a letter of reprimand, you know, which is a slap on the wrist. It usually means that, you know, your career is not going to continue.
Now, what do you make of the encyclopedia quality of this? Are they trying to assemble a words to live by sort of notion here? Is this a sense of the morality within DOD? Is this just an HR exercise? And do you get any sense that this sort of stuff is rising in the Pentagon?
Right. So I think that they're, you know, the military often refers to these as the 10 percenters, the kind of bad apples that you're always going to encounter. And those of us who cover the military know that, you know, the military in many ways is a reflection of society. And so there's no real surprises there. The cases are awesome to read about because they're just so interesting. I think the darker fear in all of this is that, as I say, that there are some more problems among senior officers, some of which are cataloged here, some of which are coming out in newspaper coverage even in the last few days. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, spoke with the Wall Street Journal in an article that appeared this morning about the need to kind of get back at all this stuff and reinstill in the senior officers that they themselves are focused on what they're supposed to be doing. And the interesting thing here is that, you know, the wars are ending. The reverence for the military has never been higher, really, on some level. But I think the fear is that you start to see some of these fissures, some of these cracks, and the perception of the military and of senior officers in particular, maybe, among the public could begin to change.
Gordon Leubold, national security reporter for Foreign Policy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A whole encyclopedia of ethical lapses. Would they fill 26 volumes? What have you seen or done in your own workplace? Would those lapses fill a book?
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm from Boston. I came out to my staff that I was trans and I was fired about a week later, despite having a huge stack of positive reports. And this is a company that claimed to be, you know, open and progressive. They just couldn't deal with having a trans woman on staff.
This is Shelley from Beaverton, Oregon. I think the worst ethical failures I've seen over the years at prior workplaces have been sexual harassment that the Human Resources Department knew about, expensing strip club activities in the evening, sleeping around at sales conferences, and the employees still continue to work there.
There's downright sabotage in South Texas.
I'm Sean from San Antonio, and working in a medical research lab, we try to stay as ethically sound as possible, but sometimes workmates will try to sabotage, unfortunately, your experiment.
And in New York, this is more annoying. A listener from Briar Park writes, "The most depressing failure I try to fight against is that of coworkers who cannot resist taking food from the fridge that doesn't belong to them." That happens a lot around here. Give us your take. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.